My friends and I looked at each other in dismay. We felt as if we were trapped in a Dantean circle of hell and were so sorry that Turi, with all his vast potential, was similarly trapped here, and did not even know it. When Uri's act came on, it was at least a relief, because the electronic music and lights stilled. The youngsters came out of their rock stupor and seemed to come to life when Uri did telepathy and psychokinesis demonstrations for them. I began to feel during this show as if I were on the wrong trip and would do better to leave Israel and Uri and do something more scientific and less complicated. We left the Turin about 11:30 p.m., quite depressed about the prospects of research with Uri. It was just past midnight when Uri lay down on the living room couch of apartment 61 to cooperate in an attempt at hypnosis. It was now the morning of December 1, 1971. Reuven, Jeddah, Itzhak, and Iris quietly gathered around to see how I would fare in trying to hypnotize the unhypnotizable Uri. When all was quiet, I explained to Uri that even though he was going to be hypnotized, he would remember everything that happened in this first session. We would only explore things of interest to Uri that had happened in this lifetime. We started. I simply had Uri count backward from 25. He said, 25. 24, 23, 22, 21, 20, 19, 18, and he was in a deep hypnotic trance. I asked him to look around and tell me where he was. He said he was in a cave in Cyprus just above Nicosia with his dog, Joker. I asked him what he was doing here. He said, I come here for learning. I just sit here in the dark with Joker. I learn and learn, but I don't know who is doing the teaching. What are you learning? It is things like I told you last August when we first met. It is about people who come from space. But I am not to talk about these things yet. Is it secret? I asked. Yes, but someday you too will know. All right, Uri, now let us go back to the time before you moved to Cyprus. Where are you now? Suddenly Uri began to talk in Hebrew. I quickly realized that Uri had not learned English until he moved to Cyprus. I did not want to disturb Uri now, so I asked his permission to allow Itzhak Bentov to take over the interview in Hebrew. Uri gave his consent. I turned him over to Itzhak. Uri recounted in Hebrew a number of childhood episodes that are not of any importance here. Then he told of when, just after his third birthday, he was playing one day in a garden across the street from his home at Rehov Bet Sail Ye 13 in Tel Aviv. Uri looked up from his playing and saw a large shining ball-shaped light in the sky above him. The day was December 25, 1949. Then there was a huge, very bright shining figure in front of him in the garden. The shining figure had no face that could be seen, only a radiant countenance. Uri gazed at this radiance in total hypnotism. Then he became aware of arms slowly moving out from the side of the body of the radiance. The arms were raised over the head of the radiance, and then Uri saw that held between the hands was the sun. It was so blazing in its brightness that Uri passed out from the power of its rays, with the pain of blindness. Now there appeared a voice in the room speaking in English that was not Uri's voice. I'm not sure where the voice came from. But all of us in the room heard it. It may have come from the air above Uri. It may have come from Uri. I do not remember exactly what this voice said, and there is no record of its words. I will shortly try to reconstruct as best I can what was said. When the hypnosis session ended, Uri awakened. He could scarcely believe that he had been under hypnosis for an hour and a half. He had no memory of what had occurred, so we started to tell him of the unearthly, almost mechanical voice that had occurred near him. It was quite obvious that he did not believe what we were saying. So I proceeded to play back portions of the tape where he could hear his own voice. When we reached the part where he was a three-year-old in the garden, he began to show signs of fear and terror. He kept muttering, "I don't remember any of this." When we reached the part that said, "This is the voice," Uri deftly ejected the tape cassette and held it in his left hand. He paused momentarily, looking at the cassette, closed his fist over it, and I believe that I saw the cassette disappear from his hand. Then he rushed out of the apartment door, heading toward the elevators. We searched the building, top to bottom, inside and out. He was not to be found. Yuri had truly vanished. We assembled in apartment 61 in a half hour to go over the event. We decided that we had better call the police, because Yuri had slipped out of the building past the door guard somehow, and if he was still in trance, he could endanger himself. We also decided to make one last search of the building before calling the police. As I pressed the button on the sixth floor and opened the swinging door to the elevator, there was Yuri with his back to the far wall like a standing mummy. He didn't seem to be conscious, so I addressed him gently. He suddenly awakened and said, "Where am I?" I simply said, "You are all right. Come back to the apartment with me." He meekly followed me and sat down on the couch in a daze. He had no memory of where he had been for the past half hour. He was still in a state of emotional shock. I decided that he had better go home to bed. Iris offered to drive him home and to look after him. After Iris and Uri left, we sat down to try to reconstruct what the voice had said. This is what we remembered, but none of us was certain of the exact wording. It was us here and elsewhere. The reader will note grammatical errors in the speech of the extraterrestrial beings. This is how the messages were delivered. No attempt has been made to alter their words in any way. Who found Uri in the garden when he was 3. He is our helper sent to help man. We programmed him in the garden for many years to come, but he was also programmed not to remember. On this day his work begins. Andrea, you are to take care of him. We reveal ourselves because we believe that man may be on the threshold of a world war. Plans for war have been made by Egypt, and if Israel loses, the entire world will explode into war. There will be one last round of negotiations that may not avert war. America is the problem. The negotiations will not succeed. The Egyptians have as of now no fixed date to start the war. The critical dates as are figured by Israel are correct as of now. The critical dates as seen by us are, December 12th, 15th, 20th, 25th, 26th, 1971, or nothing at all. Now the reader must be reminded that the rumors of a new war were always in the air in Israel, so that there was no particular novelty to the statement that plans for war had been made. Plans for war were in continuous existence in the Middle East. The real question always was when and where would war be triggered? Our real problem was to find out more about the when and where and to have more certainty about the information. There were more things said, but I dare not write them down because I might not be accurate. My Israeli friends were linked to the Israeli Army Command, and they pondered all night long what to do with this information. One of their difficulties was that they didn't know how much credence to place on this kind of utterance. They were prepared to believe that we had all hallucinated the entire scene. I was the only one who was sure that I had seen the tape cassette vanish in Uri's hand. When dawn came, we had not reached any conclusion as to what to do. Yuri appeared at the apartment at 2 p.m. December 1st. He didn't seem to remember anything of the events of the previous night. I decided that the best policy was not to go into it all again, to wait and see what would happen. If there was a real war threat, I felt that we would be contacted again. As it happened, I was alone with Uri, since both Reuven and Itzhak had to keep prior appointments. One of the first things that I noticed about Uri was that he seemed very relaxed and full of quiet self-confidence. He walked by one of the magnetic compasses on the test platform and absent-mindedly put his hand over it. It immediately turned 30 degrees. He had never been able to get this effect before so easily or quickly. I could sense that something had changed for the better. At 3:30 p.m. I placed a coded machine steel ring inside a wooden microscope box. The ring had been specially prepared by Bentoff in his machine shop, to see if Uri could bend it. Yuri said, "Why did you put the ring in the box?" I said I really didn't know. Yuri in a very authoritative way said, "Take a movie of putting the ring in the box, and I will make it vanish." His sudden self-confidence was new to me. I did as he requested. He placed his hand on the closed wooden box for about 2 minutes, then said, "I think the ring has vanished. Check the box." I cautiously opened the box lid. The ring had vanished. This is the first time I had experienced an object vanishing where I was certain there had been no deception involved. I had to stop routine experimental work now and talk to Ri about the previous night. I repeated what had happened. I could see that he felt that I was making up the whole story to fool him. He could not remember anything. So I did not press the matter. Yuri then got very excited and asked me to buy him a Polaroid camera. I said, "Yuri, I have a Polaroid back for my Hasselblad camera. I can take any pictures you wish." "Well, that's not it, Andrea. I need the camera for myself. Besides, I can't learn to use your complicated camera. Please trust me, buy me the camera. You'll never regret it." "Okay, let's go to Tel Aviv and see if we can buy you a simple Polaroid camera, and I'll teach you how to use it." I purchased the Polaroid camera and color, and black and white film packs. Yuri learned how to take pictures after a dozen tries. He was so happy with the camera that he stopped in the middle of the street and said he would move my watch. He put his hand casually over my wristwatch, and the hands moved from 6:55 p.m. to 7:55 p.m. Then, for good measure, he waved his hand over an apartment key that I held, and it bent about 30 degrees. We drove back to the apartment to find Itzhak awaiting us. He urged me to do another hypnosis session with Uri, just to verify the previous night's happenings. Yuri got involved in the discussion, saying that he couldn't remember what had happened but was now getting curious about it. He suggested that we might ask for some kind of a sign as to what to do. I suggested what I considered to be an impossible sign. "If Uri can bring back the coded steel ring that vanished this afternoon, I'll concede that we may be dealing with a superintelligence and that we ought to follow their suggestions. The reason I say this is that returning a steel ring takes us personally out of the class of mass hallucination, or a fraud on Uri's part." This suggestion was accepted, and Itzhak examined the microscope box where the steel ring had vanished earlier that day. Finding it to be devoid of any ring, and with no possibility of deception being used, we went ahead with the test. Yuri held his hand over the box for some 15 minutes without any result. Then he asked me to place my finger on the side of the box facing north. This I did while everyone hovered near the box. Suddenly we all simultaneously heard the sound of a metal object falling inside the closed box and settling down with a clatter on the bottom. We looked at each other. It was silently agreed that I should open the box. When I did, there was the steel ring that had vanished 6 hours earlier. This was a clear mandate from heaven, if I may borrow the Chinese expression. I went right ahead and hypnotized Uri. This time the voice appeared in the room as soon as Uri was in a deep trance state. I recorded the entire session, which lasted for 60 minutes. When Uri awoke, he looked at the clock and said, "I have a show in Tel Aviv at midnight. I must leave here in 10 minutes," so I quickly spot-checked the tape. It had recorded properly, and we all heard that it had. I would not let Uri drive to Tel Aviv so soon after a hypnosis session and insisted that I take him there. On the road to Tel Aviv, as we passed the area just south of Herzliya, Uri complained of a sudden pain in the forehead area between the eyes. He asked me to stop the car because he felt sick. I did this. I also took out my Sony TC-120 tape recorder, which still had the tape in it from the second, most recent, hypnosis session. I could see that Uri was going to say something, so I tried to make the tape recorder work. I found that the tape cassette was okay, but the start and record buttons were jammed and would not engage. Then Uri suddenly said, "Remember every word I said to you because the evidence is gone." I again looked into the tape recorder. The cassette that had been there moments before had vanished. Uri came to, his headache eased off, and he was able to do his show in Tel Aviv. We returned to the apartment in Herzliya Heights at 2 a.m. to find Itzhak waiting for us. He grimly informed me that after hearing the voice speak the second time, he felt a moral obligation to report it to the Israeli army. I then told him how the tape recording of this second session with Uri had vanished. This meant that we had to sit up all night again to reconstruct what had been said. Uri then informed us that he had a show scheduled in the Sinai Desert for the army and he could not be with us the next day. with apologies to Itzhak, he begged me to go along with him. He felt I must be there. Itzhak consented, and I agreed. Yuri bade us good night and left. We now tried to reconstruct what had happened earlier that evening. This is what we remembered. Yuri said, "I am flying out of my body somewhere on Earth. It is a flat, wide place with no vegetation, and there are some mountains in the background. There I see two figures. One is Andrea, looking very young with all black hair and no gray. Itzhak is there, too. He is not bald and has full black hair. Then I flew to another place. It is the place where Andrea served in the army." All this was said in Uri's voice. I had worked as a civilian in the USA hospital at Fort Hood, California, in 1959. Then Uri's voice stopped, and the voice appeared. Again we were not sure where it came from. It said, "I'm now looking over the flat place in the Sinai where there are enormous numbers of tanks. Attack first. Don't wait. In Khartoum and in Egypt there may be many dead. Sadat will be taken by his officers. Syria will attack. Jordan will not intervene. There will be many Egyptian soldiers in Jordan. You are the only one to save mankind. The earth will be exploded by man himself, not by us. Yuri, you have been given enormous powers, you can do everything and anything. Yuri, you are very powerful. I will call you when I want you." The session ended. Other things were said, but they are not directly related to the suggested immediate war threat. They had to do with what would happen if Israel took the initiative and either won the war or averted a war. If Israel entered into a preemptive war, there was the danger of escalation to world war. If Israel prevented a war now, she would still have to face a major war in the future with her Arab neighbors, but in this latter scenario there was no danger of escalation into a world war. I omit all the ramifications of these contingencies because they do not bear directly on the immediate threat of war. My Israeli friends now decided to seek an appointment with a key figure in the army for December 3 on my return from the Sinai. However, they insisted that I go with them in order to lend credence to all the psychic aspects of the information. At 6 p.m. December 2, Uri and I arrived at the military section of Lod Airport on our way to Uri's show in the Sinai Desert. Uri made it clear that only personnel cleared by the Israeli army were allowed to go to the war zone in the Sinai. He told me to sit down in the terminal and keep my mouth shut. He would try to get me on the plane. First he went to the military ticket agent, who refused to give tickets for my passage because I did not have the proper papers. Yuri then went to Sergeant Major Aaron, no tickets because of no clearance papers. In a half hour Yuri had the entire airport in an uproar, insisting that if I, his friend, did not go to the Sinai, there would be grave international repercussions. Although it looked impossible for me to go on this flight to the Sinai, I secretly knew that if I had to go, some miracle would happen and I would go. As 7 p.m. approached and the plane was ready to depart, Yuri unexpectedly got clearance for me to get aboard the plane. However, it was stated that my security clearance would be checked. To this day we do not know why I was allowed to go. We both had wide grins of satisfaction as the Viscount lifted off the runway and we were off to some unknown airbase in the middle of the Sinai Desert. The pilot received word by radio 35 minutes out of Tel Aviv that my security status was okay. We landed in the midst of the cold, wintry desert on an airstrip without any buildings. Several trucks met the plane as it rolled to a stop, and an officer rushed up to Uri to welcome him. The first words from the officer were that some Egyptian commandos had infiltrated the area and that a battle alert was on. The second words were the passwords for the night. We were in the war zone. After a cold and bumpy ride to a base camp, we were fed in the mess hall. As we ate, we were surrounded by officers and soldiers who showed an unabashed hero worship for Uri. Here on the war front, the normal reserve of civilian life in Israel was dropped. Everyone was alert with electric excitement. There was no discernible gap between the officers and the rank and file soldiers. The big excitement in the air was not that the Egyptian commandos were lurking somewhere in the dark, but that Uri's show was scheduled for 11 that evening. As an American, I was fascinated by this cavalier spirit. Yuri turned their interest in the show around by first asking for, and then demanding, a jeep. He insisted that he must go into the desert immediately, and alone. The officers did their best to talk Yuri out of taking a jeep into the desert night. They insisted that it was dangerous, but if he must go, he had to be driven under escort by armed guards. Finally, a compromise was reached. Yuri and I could have a jeep, a driver, and an armed soldier. If the driver or guard sensed danger, we would have to abide by their orders. Yuri accepted this, and we went out into the frigid desert night to a waiting jeep. The driver said that he and the guard had to make a stop at their barrack to pick up a rifle and a machine gun. We pulled up to the barrack, and the driver remained in the jeep with Yuri and me while the other soldier went in to get the guns. I noticed that when the young soldier returned, he was bareheaded. I thought it was strange. If there was so much danger, why did he not wear a steel helmet? At exactly 9 p.m. we drove past the gate sentries out of the camp. All of us, except Avram, the young soldier, buckled on our helmets, and the jeep roared out into the night. Now, I must confess that I had no idea where we were in the Sinai, or even where the cardinal points of the compass were. My disorientation was such that I could have been on the moon. At 9:02 p.m. Yuri leaned over to me in the dark and whispered, "Now I'm getting a message, 30K, what does it mean? 30K, R, now I get it. It means 30 kilometers. We must drive 30 kilometers to be met by the red light." We noted the speedometer reading. Every time we reached a fork or intersection in the road, Yuri insisted that I make the decision as to whether to turn left or right. I did this purely in a random fashion. Yuri then whispered to me, "Our teacher said to us that he is going to appear to us as a red light that will look like a UFO." Now I finally knew why Yuri wanted me to go to the Sinai Desert with him. By now I had located the constellations and the stars in the sky which gave me the cardinal points of the compass. The excitement built up in us as the speedometer moved up to the 30-kilometer mark. Just as it turned from 29 to 30 km, I spotted a red light in the sky to the northwest, at about a 315/B0 bearing and an elevation of about 18/B0 above the horizon. I silently pointed it out to Yuri. He dismissed it by saying, "That's just a radio tower light." But then he immediately ordered the driver to stop the jeep and turn it around so that the headlights would face away from the red light in the sky. We both jumped out of the jeep, and the driver and guard got out to keep an eye on us. Neither Yuri nor I said a word. We looked at the red light from a spot about 30 meters from the road. Yuri kept whispering, "It can't be our red light." I took out an American penny, held it at arm's length in the direction of the red light, and judged the light to be about 10 times the diameter of the brightest star in the heavens. This is a common technique used by star watchers. The red light was motionless in the sky above a mountain peak. I later identified this peak as Mount Ugrat Laird, which has an elevation of 1,791 meters. Since the night was quite bright, it soon became obvious that there was no tower below the light, so we abandoned the idea that it was a radio tower light. It was the quality of the red light that intrigued me. It was like the clearest of claret wine. It didn't seem to shine or sparkle like the stars, but it seemed to me as if one could look into it, and through it, as if looking into a human eye. Then Yuri and I decided that we were probably hallucinating. I asked Yuri to go to the driver and the guard to point to where the light was and see if they saw what we saw. Yuri walked over to them and spoke in Hebrew, since they did not speak English. He returned in a few minutes. He reported the following sequence. He approached the two men and, pointing to the red light, asked them what they saw. They said they saw the outline of the mountain. He said, "I don't mean the mountain, I mean above it." They said, "Stars, just stars." "Well, isn't there supposed to be a radio tower on that mountain?" Yuri pressed. "Not to our knowledge," they replied. "Well, I would have sworn I saw a red light on that mountain," Yuri said while looking directly at the light. They looked at the mountain again. "There's no tower, and no red light," they replied. Then Yuri said to me, "They don't see what we see." I stated rather flatly, Then you and I must be imagining the red light, because we want to fulfill our wishes. Yuri said weakly, for the past day I have been pushing to get you to the Sinai. I got you here, now we don't even know what we are seeing. So we stood in the cold night stillness, staring at what now felt like a red eye in the star-studded sky. How could we be sure of what we were experiencing? Yuri broke the silence. Quick, move 5 feet to the left. I paced off this distance and looked around. Nothing. Then my foot touched something soft. I reached down, it was a soldier's fatigue cap. I picked it up and showed it to Yuri. That's it, he said. That's the sign. What do you mean, that's it? I replied, annoyed. That's just some soldier's cap that blew off his head as he was driving by. No, no. It's a sign. Take it. Take it. Reluctantly, I rolled up the cap and stuffed it into my pocket. I just couldn't understand why he attached any importance to this rag. We stood there another 10 minutes looking at the red eye in the sky, which now seemed to have a sharp disc-like edge. Its red clarity seemed to pull my gaze into it and through it. But I did not know what I was seeing, nor if I was seeing anything at all. Now I was beginning to feel cold, and Yuri and I walked back to the jeep. Yuri tried once more to elicit a response out of the two soldiers about the red light, but they simply did not see it. I regretted that cameras were forbidden in the war zone. One-time exposure would have settled all our doubts. We climbed back into the jeep. With the night air blowing, it was now colder than ever. I took off my steel helmet and absent-mindedly put on the soldier's cap I had found in the desert. I was sitting in front, alongside Avram, who was now driving. The red light was still in the sky to our left, and I strained toward the driver to get a better view. Yuri and I both saw that the red light was moving and was, in fact, following us. But our two soldiers, while they kept looking in the direction we were staring at, did not see what we saw. Suddenly the driver flipped on the map light and stared closely at my cap. "Where did you get my cap?" he asked in puzzlement. A big excited discussion started in Hebrew in which we learned the following facts. When Avram had gone into his barrack to get the guns, he had tossed his fatigue cap on his bunk just as he walked out of the barrack. Now he pointed out that I was wearing his cap with his name written on it in his own handwriting. He wanted to know what trick I had used to obtain his cap, since I had not been out of his sight at all. Yuri tried to explain in Hebrew that we had really found the hat where we had stopped. Neither soldier would accept this explanation. While the three young men argued in Hebrew about this trick, I buried myself in thought. I already had proof that Yuri could make objects vanish and then to make them reappear. So it was possible that Avram's cap had disappeared from the barrack by the same kind of power and appeared at our feet in the desert. But Yuri had already said to me that he had not willed this event. He had only sensed a message to look for something. Yuri had been obsessed with getting me to the desert. Why did Yuri and I see the red light and the soldiers not see it? Were our minds being controlled? If so, whose minds? The soldiers? Or Uri's and mine? Did this red light have something to do with the voice? And what was the voice? A fragment of Uri's mind? A spirit? A god? Did the voice have any relationship to the nine that had reached me so many years ago? The red light that followed our jeep now seemed to be totally unlike what I had seen in the sky in Ossining, New York, in 1963 or in Brazil in 1968. My mind wandered to a memory I had of the Prophet Muhammad and of his experience of a star in these very deserts. Before God revealed himself, Muhammad had the practice of retiring for 1 month each year to meditate on Mount Hira. Here he saw a star descend toward him. Of this experience the Quran says, "By the star, when it descends, your brother is not dismayed." It was at the highest horizon, then it descended and remained suspended. It was 2 bows lengths away, or thereabout. Quoted in Paul Thomas, Flying Saucers Through the Ages, London, Neville Spearman Limited, 1965, p. 175, but after that first visit from the star, the Prophet had to wait 3 years before it came again. I wondered whether Muhammad's star was related to what I was looking at now. Would I ever see it again? As we turned into the base camp, the red light just winked out. Avram made one last attempt to find out how I had stolen his cap. I could only repeat what I had said earlier.